Obsession number 26809, Reel 4.
I was so good in with the insulation, full insulation. The cold was difficult to believe, and when it was extreme, one couldn't breathe in the open. It was so painful. Later, some genius invented the blower, made with empty tins and scraps of. Lined with mud. It worked like a smith's forge. The fan turned by hand, blowing air up through the small pieces of pinched coal. All matchsticks gave an intense heat and quickly boiled water for tea. The faster the handle was turned, the whiter the heat. All over the camp, men could be seen crouching over their blowers, furiously turning the handles, making columns of smoke rise over the camp from the sacrificial fires of kneeling worshippers to the great tea god. Men played cards continually, all day and every day, and I played some chess. So much I haven't really played since. The only interruption was when soup came, and everybody lined up, Dixie's at the ready. And a man with a stick continually stirred the soup whilst it was being ladled out to distribute the bits equally. The camp had a hidden radio, and news from the BBC was regularly typed out each week and passed round. The soap we received in the Red Cross parcels was good currency to the German guards, and cigarettes, once a guard accepted anything, he could be blackmailed for all sorts of items, like bringing in wireless parts. We had an escape committee, and I know Sergeant Greet was in charge. With Rodney Gray, who was a sign writer by trade, produced wonderful forgeries for passes, passports, and geprüft stamps from heels of boots using a pin. To my knowledge, there weren't any escapes, though some attempts were made. I remember early on a long tunnel was dug from one of the barracks, beginning at the entrance to the barrack, where a large bucket was left as a night commode. The problem of shoring and strengthening it was wood, but the bedboards of the tier bunk beds were used, and in their place Red Cross string was knotted to form a hammock. The tunnel reached outside the wire on the edge of the adjacent forest, but a few hours before it was due to surface, a squad of guards marched to the camp, surrounded it, went straight to the bucket, and months of sweat, blood and tears, with the hope of all the toilers, were destroyed in seconds. There were German spies in the camp who, posing as prisoners, would report all camp activities and plans to escape. This made everybody suspicious of prisoners who appeared from nowhere, and that is, who were unknown in any of the units or were without any friends. All the personnel of our general hospital had been captured, so we all knew each other. Mysterious deaths did occur infrequently, and when there was a subsequent inquest or inquiry, one assumed a spy had been discovered and removed. Once a hand had been found floating in a reservoir, a tank of water situated in the camp for firefighting, but nobody ever solved the mystery, neither a body, handless or otherwise, nor the identity of the hand was ever discovered. Camp concerts were always in rehearsal somewhere in one of the barracks, and 29A was used as a concert hall. Shakespeare and the classics and variety, with Denholm Elliott and Clive Dunn, and Christmas pantomimes were all performed throughout the year. And choral performances of Gilbert and Sullivan, like Merry England and the Mikado, as well as performances by the Stalag Orchestra. The Stalag schools thrived, with students taking exams with papers sent from England and taken under strict supervision by the tutors. I had an exhibition of many of my Stalag paintings and drawings, The highlight was my portrait of a Canadian captured at Dieppe, a tall, gaunt-faced and bearded commando who was explaining the action with his hands in chains. Chains had replaced the Red Cross string, and Jerry had discovered the ruse of comrades untying their friends and were now using chains on the wrist about 12 inches in length. They didn't realize they were being unlocked again with sardine tin openers. Boredom, frustration, living in a world apart, these were the daily ingredients for us, and every device was used by human ingenuity to create diversions and mental escape. Books were always exchanged, and men would wander from compound to compound with a book in hand, seeking an exchange. The unvarying German diet of one loaf between 5 or 7 men, a scrap of margarine, a small piece of sausage once a week, cabbage sweet soup, or sauerkraut continued with sometimes Hun cheese, usually described as stinking cheese. We received Red Cross parcels, 2 men per parcel once a week, except when they were stopped as a punishment. This punishment for the whole camp of 12,000 was normal if a prisoner disobeyed a guard or behaved improperly in any way to the Germans. When Group Captain Bader was transferred to the camp, he was the legless pilot who was shot down over Berlin. He was with us a few days when he was sweeping the road with a broom. And a working party had been searched before proceeding to the factory. And as they marched out of camp between the second and third fence, they passed Bader, who gave the broom to a marcher, who stepped out and started sweeping the road, and Bader took his place and marched out with the rest of the workers. He was soon missed, and when the working party arrived at the factory, everyone was ordered to drop their trousers. He couldn't hide his wooden legs. We went without parcels for 2 weeks. The first repatriation exchange began in late 1943, and badly wounded sick personnel with some medical corps were exchanged. I was among others to staff the camp hospital, and I was working as a nurse for many months, during which the Italians were fighting our invasion, and the Germans had transferred all the Italian prisoners and wounded to Germany. One notable hospital train that came to us was one that, passing through the Brenner Pass, had been bombed and machine-gunned by Jerry planes. I still correspond with one of my old patients, a Reg Bartholomew, who had his leg amputated. The big Russian offensive of Christmas 1944 began a nightmare of waiting to be rescued. As the German army retreated and we heard the barrage of heavy guns day and night, we expected the Russians to march up the road every day, but nothing happened day after day. Finally, in February, the evacuation of Camp Stadag B and our hospital was ordered, and the Camp Kriegers began to march west. Several escaped, but the bitter weather with snow, very deep, and with little food, made the going very difficult. Our walking patients were sent with them, and the staff of our hospital accompanied our stretcher cases. The same routine of cattle trucks, this time with our stretcher patients, too, resumed and continued for 4 days through Germany in bitter, snow-covered country. Finally, the train halted for longer than usual, and we were all marched through small villages for hours, till we reached a camp on the outskirts of Memmingen, south of Munich. Memmingen had a large railway junction which in March was attacked by a large force of American bombers. But fortunately we were spectators, and only afterwards the full horror of it struck us when we were marched into the town. We were sent in squads to rescue and the injured and look after our fellows that were digging, of course, and trapped in the bombed houses. We were grateful to have our German guards for protection as we marched through the town amidst the shocked, angry and sorrowing people. It became evident as the days passed that our liberation was not far off. Large Red Cross flags were flown at the corners of the camp, and the guards became very friendly and more scarce. Distant gunfire came nearer every hour, and soon the staff who were in the building housing our patients were straining their eyes looking for signs of our liberators. Rumours changed minute by minute. They have seen the tanks, they have seen smoke, and a white flag was seen hanging from the town hall. The memorable day came on April the 26th. Mid-morning, the camp lit up with electric excitement as tanks were seen approaching. All the prisoners surged to the main gate, shaking and laughing with disbelief. We were all jammed up against the main gates as more and more prisoners pressed forward. Some clambered over the top, heedless of the barbed wire, as a tank with the American flag moved slowly towards us. The gate remained closed. Where the key or the lock was, no one knew, but suddenly the gate burst open, and the dense, cheering crowd poured out onto the tank, which was now stopped, and an officer stood in the turret firing his pistol, and the shot quietened our laughter and wild cheers. "Nice to see you," the officer drawled, "but don't go down into the town yet. It could be quite dangerous." We did go down to the town later on, when the military police were on patrol as protection. 3 weeks later, Dakota American aeroplanes flew us to Rouen, and the next day, in a Wellington bomber, we flew over the white cliffs of Dover.